feel the connection, because that's the Sangha. That's where our heart thrives within the gathering, which is what Sangha literally means, the gathering of like-minded hearts. And there's a beautiful reciprocity of spirit that draws each other and feeds upon each other, reinforces each other in the proximity of those who are well-intended. You know, in hospice care, we used to have a sanghas of people who were well-intended, and the dearness of coming together with around people who were dying brought that tenderness out. Well, truth brings that tenderness out too. And as we're all here in the service of truth, honesty, straightforwardness, saying what is true. God, I don't know what, like, I don't understand how that could not be an important component for all of us. But in any case, that's what we're here for. And that's why we're drawn together. And let me also say that sometimes my language and sometimes the Dharma that I suggest us viewing can feel very distant to where you actually are or your own Dharma practice. And it feels like a long reach for you to even be able to assume some of the exercises or to embody some of the Dharma principles that I'm suggesting. Let me clear this up for you very clearly. If you're interested, if you're listening from interest, if you're drawn into even hearing this, you are very close to it. Your mind may put you distant and far away. Your mind may think that you can abstract distance and can separate you from what you are hearing, but your heart speaks otherwise. And that is within your interest, within your attentiveness. I remember very early on, I was always attended when a teacher would move into the ultimate Dharma or the absolute Dharma, as I would call it, as opposed to the relative Dharma. What I'm talking about is the thinning of self, but when he or she would move out into the realms of wonder, my eyes would light up, and I often had no idea what they're talking about, but I knew it was there inside of me to entice and to bring forward. And so it's also true for all of us as well. Don't put yourself too far away. Be very cautious in separating yourself out from this at all, because It really is, as the title suggests, we're becoming the mystery we already are. We're becoming what we already are. The already are may feel not so close to you, but from the person's point of view, there is a becoming of it too. Those two coincide with each other, the becoming of it and the R of it. In fact, this goes out a little bit. There's some hesitancy in me to say, okay. All of that is arising together. The becoming and the already are already manifesting. In fact, all of time is manifesting simultaneously. Your ancestors are here in the room with you. All of time, it's not linear. It's vertical. All of it is happening at the same time, in this moment, now. And so when I draw upon a wisdom of the past, like what the Buddha said, or when I draw upon a Mahayana wisdom of the past, like the Heart Sutta, to me, those are all instantaneously present now, simultaneously arising and inviting us together in the message, the overall message of it all. And that's how time comes together within the mystery, mysteriously. And so what we're doing here and what we were suggesting yesterday are ways to, prepare to meet the mystery, even as we are already a part of that mystery. How is it that we can narrow our defenses so that we don't become confused by this passageway into the more mysterious part of life? How can we slim ourselves down so that we're not so insulated from the mystery when it does and will impart itself to us? It has to. It is us. It has to impart itself to us. It has to. It has to get in. It's there already. It doesn't even have to get in. It's just there. It has to emanate. That's what it has to do. So what we're trying to do is to decrease the density so that it can emanate. The culture needs us. The world needs us. The universe needs us. And I need us. We all need ourselves. We all need ourselves in our authentic expression of ourselves. The authentic expression of ourselves. You see, why you're doing this changes along with the thinning. At first, it's because I'm hurting and I want to get over my hurt. And that evolves into, how can I, you get, all beings. That's where the bodhisattva vow comes in. It comes in the thinning process, not in some sectarian part of Buddhism. It just comes out of the heart in a natural response to the heart. Because we're thin enough to see beyond just I as an individual, into the collective, into the interconnected, into the oneness, into the unity, into the complete mystery of us all being together. This then is where the journey is going. And what I'm suggesting is how to undertake and become and evolve into that mystery prior to the awakening experience that we already are at. Some of us have had that experience, which is great. Some of us haven't. Doesn't matter. You're no less of a mystery to the universe in either direction. There's just a little thickening of self that we need to get through. So how can we live our life? How can we live our life in the direction of thinning ourselves so that we are ready for this mystery when it reveals itself? And the fact is that sometimes, and I've known people, many people really, who sometime in their childhood or late childhood or early teens or something, they have this extraordinary opening into the revelation of what they really are. And it throws them off. It throws them off to such devastation because they hadn't prepared for it. They hadn't had any predisposition towards it. They hadn't had any working out the settling down into the certainty of it. And so, and I've seen that well into adulthood as well as well into Dharma practice. And I wonder sometimes, what did you expect to happen to you in Dharma practice? Did you think we were going to stay insulated? You think you were just going to stay as you? That's not what Dharma practice does. It changes. It evolves us out of ourselves. That's what it does. That's its point and its purpose. And so let's start from the beginning in that direction. Let's move it in the direction that it already is pointing, rather than resist that by just enclosing ourselves in the bubble of me, of what I want from Dharma and how good it is or whatever it's doing to me, or the consistent message that of what I'm getting out of it. And let's spread our hearts. So one of the ways to do that is both through the methodology that we practice, which I talked about yesterday, in terms of rediscovering that methodology, reawakening ourselves to it so that we start living at a deeper, richer meaning of those words like relax, observe, and allow, or like the paramis, or the, so that they don't feed a sense of self-righteousness in our sila, in our ethical conduct, or in our wisdom, I'm so wise, and all that stuff, because that's obviously going in that direction is back. it's going towards a rethickening of ourselves. Let's go into the direction in which, first of all, we have a conscious awareness of where we're going. Secondly, we want to go there. We're inclined in that way. If you're not inclined in that way, this really isn't the retreat for you. I'm assuming that inclination at least an interest, if not an actual application, at least an interest. So if you're just interested but not interested in applying yourself to it, that's fine. Just listen to the curiosity of it and let that move you forward, as Dharma will. But if you're interested and inclined in the and how to do that, in the hows of it, you see, we're already coming from the sense of becoming, and which is fine, but don't conflict the becoming that we're becoming and away from in contrast to the mystery we already are. Those two are simultaneous. Those two are not paradoxical. They're paradoxical, but they're not contrasting. The reason we are in the phase of becoming is we haven't realized the mystery we are. So it's the becoming brings us to that realization by opening the doors so that we don't keep the windows locked and the doors sealed. We have the space for fresh air to get in and be touched by the mystery. And then we realize what we've always been. And so to for someone to sit up here like a teacher, which I've often heard and which really kind of disgusts me, and disclaim the practices, the methods which they had to evolve themselves in to get to where they are, feels disingenuous to me. You know, most of us aren't starting there. And just to be told that I already am something doesn't help me a bit. I just go around egoically enriched, but no deeper in insight or realization, thinking I'd love to be the mystery before I'm the mystery. I can go out and pronounce myself. But when you are the mystery, you've already done away with the need to do that. So somebody who's pronouncing themselves, question. In fact, go the other way. Okay, so we're trying to figure out how to align ourselves in the direction and encourage the mystery to be known that's within us. I have to choose my words carefully here. So how do we do that, you see? All right. I'm not going to go back and rehearse yesterday, though that I expect that's on tape. You can re-listen to it if you want to. But going forward, what values are important to us? You see, that dharmic values, values about life. And how are we acting in contrast to those values, those precious values? Well, for me, one of those values that has always, even from the beginning of Dharma practice, is to know the truth, to know the truth. That's why the political situation seems so discordant to me. I can't understand why people wouldn't want to know the truth. I've always wanted to know that. And that's been a real asset to moving forward, because it's the lack of personal defenses against the truth, or when they do come up, examining those defenses so that they don't barricade me from the truth, like denial. It doesn't mean that I don't have my own defense mechanism. I do, but they're not. But when I'm aware of them, I make sure they don't stand in contrast to that value of knowing the truth. To know your defenses is to know the truth of your defenses. So whatever is in front of us, we want to know in essence what it is and how it is robbing me of a fuller participation in a mystery that I know I am, but may not feel it as yet. Okay. So as I begin to move in that direction, I want to live the values, those values. I want to live my truthfulness. I put it on the line, you know, and it's challenged almost daily as to whether I'm going to be honest, say what's really there, not as a weapon or as a slicing or as a stab, you know, because you can use anything in accordance with the ego and make it into a weapon. I'll tell you the truth. You want to know what's really true about you? I'll tell you. No, that's not the Buddha said what's true and useful. The usefulness is the heart element of truth. truth doesn't have a heart element. It's just hard fact. You have to bring in the heart, which is to bring in the mystery, which is to bring in the spirit of us. So it's true and useful. Those are two hands of the prayer. And together they form a perfect. So you don't say, oh, you know, you've gained weight. Because it may be true, but it's so, it's just cruel. See, the sensitivity and the empathy is there as well. That's, you don't have to develop your empathy. You have to encourage it, which means you have to feel what the other person is likely feeling. You have to feel the range of your own emotions and also be able to understand someone else's. But that's just part of the unshedding of our defenses. That's just part of the willingness to open. And so whatever your values are, whatever they may be, live them. Live them as long as they're in accordance with the mystery, as long as they're in accordance with a deeper representation of yourself. And you know them because you're drawn to them. They become like this. You're drawn to this particular message because it's very close in you. Those values, if you are drawn to them, are very close in you. If they're not actually manifesting, they're very close to full manifestation, very full, close to full aliveness. And so when we start living it, we start encouraging that aliveness, which is the thinning of the sense of self, which is the ripening of the mystery within our lives. And as we move in the direction of that thinning, there will be a moment in which the mystery is revealed in its completion. But it won't catch us off guard like we were if we were 10 years old and had that happen, or if we were 40 years old and practicing in a self-contained, self-indulgent way. It happens because you're expecting it to happen. You're already it. You're just becoming, you're working your way into the wisdom of knowing that. That's what you're doing. That's what we all are doing. Okay, so that's a very different set of principles and practices than how normally people relate to their Dharma practice. You know, it's like, it's so insulated. So you will have to, it has to be porous. It has to, you have to let the air in, feel it. You know, I know many of you have reasons to feel defensive and self-protective, and because you've been hurt by life. And oftentimes that leads to a lack of trust and faith in life. And but I am not suggesting that you surrender your boundaries. I'm not suggesting that. Don't ever do that. Love has nothing to do with surrendering your boundaries, okay? The ability to say yes or no, the ability to discern what's happening to me and take yourself out of that situation, the ability not to go into neighborhoods that are crime filled out of naivete, nothing I'm saying contradicts that. Okay. And the ability to, but the lack of trust in life is in addition to having those boundaries, is not in contrast to keeping those boundaries of being able to say yes and no. That's really what it comes down to. Boundaries don't mean a split or a separation. It's like, no, you're not, this is not okay. You're doing this. Now stop it. Okay. That, oh, love, naive love, you know, it's like, okay, yeah, you can do anything you want because it's all one. Nonsense. No, don't do that. Don't do that. See, this is saying the first thinning of yourself, phase one of the practice, has so much to do with establishing our sanity, with establishing our position in life, knowing that we're here and that we can't be anywhere else. You see, that's where the moment begins to affirm us in ways that a scattered mind and discursive thinking will never confirm us, because it doesn't land on anything that's solid. But when we're sitting on the ground that we're in, we can't say, I should be sitting somewhere else. There's nowhere else to be. And the old joke that comes to mind, I'm sorry for those of you who listen to me regularly and know these old jokes, but is Nola Rasputin, or whatever his name is, anyway, the Sufi wise person and fool, was having an affair with his good friend's wife, and his good friend comes into the house, and Nola hears him upstairs and hides in the closet. And the friend comes up, opens the closet, and sees Nola and says, what are you doing here? And Nola says, well, everybody's got to be someplace. And the point being, although by your lack of smiles, I'm not sure I should have said, the point being, not to have an affair. That's not the point. The point is to own your position, to own where you are. There's only one place you can be. There's only one possibility of where you are. There's no other possibility. Well, gosh, what am I doing here? Do I deserve to be here? I don't know. You know, am I good enough to be here? Nonsense. You are here. You're here. Period. That's all there is. The here-ness is all there is. The rest is just self-doubt and a lack of faith. See, that's where the confirmation of our body is so important. And it leads to the sanity of everything, really. It aligns everything in accordance with that sanity. Now, from here, yes, no, yes, okay, great. Yeah, I'd love to. No, I don't want to do that. Everything else comes out of that sanity. But that sanity has to be established. And one of the ways that, for most of us, well, a good method of this is knowing the difference between the establishment of the sanity of now in terms of physical sensation and bodily presence and the discursive insanity of following our thoughts. Before we got involved in Dharma, all we had was our thoughts to lead us everywhere. And mostly we're insane because of having been led in that direction. Now we have a tool to line ourselves up, an invaluable tool. And we start lining ourselves up in accordance with that, establishing the sanity, the ground from which all the rest of Dharma unfolds. So we have not wasted one bit of time practicing this phase one aspect of it, even though in our minds we might think, remember, it's in our minds, not in our bodies. Our minds might think, oh, I'd like to be in high school or college, and here I am finding myself in grade school. How am I ever going to get to high school if I have to be in grade? In the same way you got to college as you go through grade school, you know, and you appreciated it when you're there. You didn't keep thinking, God, I wish I were in the 11th grade. What am I doing in the third grade? At least I didn't. I enjoyed the third grade. So let's enjoy where we are, establish ourselves in the sanity, and let the rest take care of itself so that we have boundaries in which we can say yes and no to. Okay. Okay. So as this unfolds, we have thinned ourselves because we've been doing the methods, living our values, you know, love. Love's a lot of values, you know, inclusiveness with boundaries, right? Starting to see beyond myself. Generosity is a value. Patience is a value. All of the paramis and sila and all this, they give you an immense number of values if you can't think of your own. And just line yourself up to ones that resonate with you and start living your life from that. And then you have lived a thinning life, a thinning life. As long as you don't circle it back, claim ownership of how generous I am. Oh, you're this, you only gave that much. I gave this. Don't do that. That's going back the other way. You might as well not be practicing generosity because it's not helping you. It's thickening you. So we're going this way. And so, and you'll know it. You know if your ego is getting dense. And that's the other thing is to what does the mystery mean except questions, questioning, wonder. Like one of the affirmations, and I'm not an affirmation kind of guy, but one of the affirmations that I always appreciated and from time to time I would use is let the mystery be revealed today. I was lying in bed. Just let the wondrous aspect of life show itself. Now I'm interested in the actual exchange. I'm actually the interface between myself and that wonder. Let it show itself. Let it reveal itself today. And you know, when you're open to that, what you had called coincidence or happenstance or is wonder, because those things don't cover up the wonder. By we call it, well, that was a coincidence. God, I was just thinking about that person, they'd turn around the corner and there they are. That was a coincidence. That's a lack of faith. Wonder is wondrous. There's no such thing as coincidence. It's all wonder. So don't call it something that makes it something else. Coincidence takes it out of wonder and makes it coincidence. You see? You don't downplay life. Life is showing itself and we're downplaying it. We're re-entitling. We're titling it something different than what it is. If you want to be spontaneous, don't question it. You question it, you're not spontaneous anymore. You know, it's, anyway, so you get a sense of how to move this thing forward so that we free ourselves up from the burdens of our mind because we're aligned now with something much more direct and immediate and grounded and sane and allows wonder to just expand outward. And so I want to question things, which I'm giving you the thinning ways to work, but we're moving into the transition between thinning and actually shifting our identities. To encourage that forth, you start questioning the solidity of your own psyche, where you have frozen yourself in. Because there are needs inside of us, fears inside of us, that if I wasn't in control, the whole world would be out of control. When I was little, I had an alcoholic this and an abusive that, and I had to protect myself and lock my room and all of that. And so the need for control grew out of all of that pain that I had when I was young. All whatever our storyline is what I'm saying is locks us into certain assumptions about life that rob us of the mystery. And we have to re-challenge those through therapy. And there's some good trauma therapies that help you, or just therapy in general is a spiritual tool to do that. You don't think of it as, oh, I'm going into the cycle. It's all, if we're growing or moving or pointing ourselves towards a thinning process, we are engaged in a skillful means that helps us do just that. And you'll know it. If it makes you self-satisfied or have you blame your mother for all your worries, that's not so helpful. If it allows you to bring up, to expose, to see, to reconnect with lost pain, that pain needs attention. That's why it's still painful. And so to bring them up, to encourage it forth is very helpful. And so we do everything we can. We use every skillful means available to us, including Dharma practice and all the different, to move ourselves in a thinning way. And we know at the time, we know the trajectory. So when it does happen, we go, oh, wow, this is amazing. It really happened. It catches us by surprise because it's so revelatory. But it's like, oh, of course that fits. That fits into everything I've been doing. Of course this happened. It doesn't blow us off the face of the earth like it has in many cases because we weren't prepared. So that's what we want to do, is we want to encourage the mystery from day one. We want to encourage the values that ripen within the mystery. We want to encourage the heart to become more inclusive with boundaries, which seems contradictory, but is not contradictory. Prove it to yourself that you can hold a boundary and not be divided. Prove it to yourself. Don't take my word. You've got to prove it to yourself. Okay. So now we have the orientation of a Dharma life. It looks rich. It looks heartfelt. It looks sensitive. It looks decent. Dharma people are weird because they're not held to conformity. So you see where it is that you're conforming and challenge it. Usually I go this direction to work. Well, I'm going to go this direction. I may get lost, but I'm going anyway. All right. It's just like challenge your conditioning so that the conditioning piles up and just all conditioning will ever do is thicken you. So if you're doing the same thing every single day, day after day, getting up blah, 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 without any change of schedule, believe me, the psyche is thickening. Because it's just in a pattern. It's in a groove. Groove is not the mystery. Mystery is wide open. It's like wondrous. What? Whoa. Like that. Let's go to areas that access that. And for some people, it's their garden. You don't have to go outside the garden. Usually it's something that's not man-made or human-made. It's something that bird watchers, there's lots of different ways to access nature, and so that it can be very helpful to do that as well. Okay, now we are getting to the new part of what I just talked about, and all of the practices associated with it have to do with the thinning of ourselves. At some point, I'm going to take this back to the practice modality now. So stay with me. Don't worry if you haven't had this experience. Again, that's not the way to listen to this, like from a sense of self-evaluation of how well or good you're doing a meditation. It's just to appreciate the wonder of the whole experience and to come along with us here. So now we're interested in exposing the mystery as best as we can, not protecting ourselves from it, not using the Dharma in such a self-involved way, which is what we are doing for that first phase one, even though it's establishing much of the base from which we can move out on in phase two, it still has a self kind of indulgent component to it, which is fine. It's fine because that's the only way it could for most people. It's the only way it could unfold. But now we're going to enter into practices, which I'm going to be explaining, into practices that enhance the mystery. Many of these practices require the basis of concentration that we practiced in phase one, of stability of mind, which in Buddhism is called samadhi, a steadiness of mind. Mental harmony is another way, so that thoughts aren't completely carting us away in every turn of the flick of the switch. And so there's a certain presence of being that has been established in phase one, which is for most people extremely important in moving beyond phase one. And phase one evolves out of itself at a certain point. For me, because I didn't have any direction to phase two, I just was told to keep doing phase one until certain experiences happened and I'd be out. It didn't work that way for me. For me, I had to reinvent my practice, reinvent my life really, so that I took into account of what was happening and the limitations of what I was doing, as well as the value of what I was doing. And then I moved forward in regards to the limitations of what my previous practice was like, and on to the next phase of my practice. So at that phase, I wanted to expose the mystery. I wasn't afraid of it. I realized that the wonder I constantly felt, and one of the true values that I was like, oh, where's the wonder in this moment? And when I say, I would take a walk with people and I would say, gosh, I wonder what that is. And they would try to explain it to me, which would rob the wonder. So I wasn't asking for an explanation. I would say, look at how wondrous is it? Can you imagine? Look at that. Isn't that amazing? I would do that sort of thing. Yeah, well, that's because the light is, you know, I don't care about the explanation of it. I care about the wonder of it. That's the end of it. I don't need the explanation. I just need to wonder. I wonder why that roof is that color. Well, it's that color because it goes with the rest of the roof. Yeah, but that, you know, anyway, you get the point. So the emphasis on wonder rather than knowing. And this comes naturally because we are more alive in wonder than we are in knowing. And knowing, you know exactly what that thing is, but you have no mystery about it. The knowing has covered the mystery. Knowing always covers, defines. By definition, knowing defines. But the problem is, we don't realize, is that knowing also isolates. What we know about this is different than what we know about that, and those two are separated by the knowing of each thing. We don't realize that. We need to explore how knowing limits us. Yes, we're in a culture of knowing, where the more you know, the higher you ascend on the ranks of whatever profession you're in, perhaps. But in terms of the spirit, it goes the opposite way. It doesn't mean you have to eliminate your knowing. You just have to suspend, get this point, because this is important. People think they have to stop knowing. You can't stop knowing. That's in the mind. That's part of the conditioned reference we have in our perception. But you can suspend only the knowing when you look at something. You see it. There's part of it that's known. Part of it, it knows what it is. If you suspend that thought associated with that object, it turns back into the mystery. So the mystery and the knowing are very close to each other, and we're emphasizing the wonder, the not knowing of that object, as opposed to what we know about it. And you can very easily do that just by looking from a different perspective. As you train yourself, it becomes much easier. Now you're actually working with wonder as opposed to knowing. And knowing was the thickening, wonder is the thinning. It's a very important quality to cultivate in yourself, right? And you get interested in those parts of you that clamp down in the knowing, or clamp down from the fear of our history, like my need to control, or my need to be perfect, or my sense for self-disdain, or my self-inadequacy, or being overwhelmed, or on and on, all those qualities in us that reveal a deeper source of pain that we have protected and not looked at for all these years, continue to bring forth these controlling, perfectionistic attitudes, rather than to, let's just look at them. Let's just see what's true about them. Maybe they will show us that we're as bad as we think that we are. But maybe they will just show us that we learned this sense of inadequacy, and that we've carried it with us, and that we have been looking at life from that, but that in fact it was just it was an unappreciated gift that I was given in childhood. And I, because it was conditioned into me, I can extinguish it. That's huge, to know that what's inside of you can be extinguished because it was conditioned. If it's something essential, if it's essential nature in you, you're not going to be able to get rid of it because it's the essential underlying nature. It can be the irreducible. Remember, we're looking for the irreducible, unconditioned aspect of ourselves. So anything that's conditioned can be extinguished. I love that. The rat stops pushing the gold bar when it doesn't get any more of a prize from pushing the bar. When the reward is gone, so is the behavior. So we can do this. We can move it in the direction of less conditioning. But you have to be willing to go there, which is hard. And I honor the fact it's difficult. But anyway, I've talked about that in many other times, many other places. I'm not going to focus there. Okay, so stay with me because this gets interesting. If it's not interesting already, because, well, it's interesting to me because it starts taking me into the wonder of the practice. Okay, so now what's interesting, what happens in meditation if we've been practicing with sincerity and in the course or movement towards wonder, is that what you'll find is that the narrower your focus, although at some point you need to have a narrow focus in order to establish your concentration and your one-pointedness and steady your samadhi and all that. So whatever I'm saying is not an absolute so that you never do the other, but you bring it in relatively to where it's needed. In general, if we're steady, our practice is opening. Is beginning to expand. Inwardly, meditation is beginning to expand beyond the confines of any particular technique. Awareness is beginning to expand it. Even though we still have a placeholder called me that thinks that he or she is the one that's doing the expanding, that placeholder is right there. You know, back in there, it can be very quiet because as you expand out, your mind gets quieter. And as it gets quieter, the objects are seen for what they are, right? Because this is an important point. Awareness holds all form, all experiences. And so once we engage in the wonders of that expansion, awareness sort of takes over the process of the meditation. Although we still think we're in there doing it, being mindful or whatever we think we're doing in there. And that's the placeholder in meditation, is subtle thinking. We suddenly realize, or eventually realize, stay with me because it may take you outside of what you know meditation to be. Okay, so just stay with me. This is where it turns. At some point, we become aware of the placeholder, awareness of the quiet conversation I'm having about what is displayed by awareness. Oh, how am I doing? Yeah, I was pretty expansive today. Yeah, I can see that. I can see what's happening here. Yeah, that commentary is our placeholder. It's the place that thinks it's in charge of what is being perceived and the opening of the meditation itself. Now listen carefully. When awareness begins to pick up the placeholder as a placeholder, not as a sense of self, because much of the thinning process, the work in phase one, was to be able to see thought as thought, not as my thought, but thought arising, emotions arising. So now with that wisdom ingrained in us, we now pick up the placeholder as part of that same process. And awareness has wisdom enough, and we have wisdom enough to release the need to be that placeholder and just listen. The listening that happens to the placeholder no longer, listen carefully, has a placeholder. There's no longer a position from which the awareness comes. The placeholder held that position. But as we get quieter and this awareness expands so that it includes the space holder, suddenly awareness is seeing. Now listen carefully, because this gets... awareness is seeing everything, including the placeholder called me. Now I am being seen. I'm no longer seeing. It's strange. It feels kind of weird. Like 360, you're being seen. It feels that way. It feels like sight all around you, and it's not coming from you. You know it's not coming from you because you're not doing it. You know it. And at some point, you begin to say, oh my God, that changes everything about my practice, everything. Because I always thought I was in control here. The placeholder always had the sense of self-centered knowledge about what was going on and what was relevant to what I need to do next. So now the placeholder has been uprooted and is being seen. So you see, am I aware of awareness, or is awareness aware of me? Awareness is aware of me. So who am I? Now, that question can obviously be very, very confusing and not such a pleasant question to ponder unless we have been following our entire path towards the thinning of self. Then we realize that the sense of self at this point was a fiction. We know it for certain that it was a fiction because it's nowhere to be found, and yet awareness is, and the profundity of the experiences are all right there. Now, I can come back into the placeholder if I wish, just by asserting my effort in that direction, or I can let it become this amazing experience in which I am now being seen. It's not the end, but it's an important milestone. So you see, now you can begin to sense that, as I mentioned yesterday, there's only been two things happening in meditation. There's the mind and there's awareness. And I thought the mind was in control of awareness. That's what mindfulness is. I am attending to what I want to attend to. That's me being in control. But now I realize that awareness is much bigger than mindfulness and sees the mind in its totality without ownership, revealing everything the mind is doing in its totality, including the sense of I, which is part of the mind. We begin to realize at this point that I was never separate than the mind. I thought I had a mind, but now I realize that I am in the mind as a part of the mental activity that the mind is expressing. And that, I hope that turns your meditation upside down. Don't try to get there, because if you try to get there, you stir up the noise of your effort. You see, this is where the ways, the means now changes in accordance to the direction our meditation is taking. If you say, oh God, that was so cool, let me get back to that. Now you've stirred up so much noise that you are now back as the placeholder, and awareness is entrenched within that placeholder because of the effort that you're imposing upon awareness. Awareness it'll go in the direction that you want to go. If you want to make it into a pea size, it'll be a pea size. If you want to make it into universal, absolutely universal, it'll be universal, because it has no boundary. It has no limitation. It has no there's nothing that corrals it except you and your effort or your desire. Desire is another expression of effort. What is really happening in meditation? Mind and awareness. Stage one, from the very first time I brought attention to the breath, I was establishing that there were two things. There's the breath and my attention. Without my attention, I didn't see the breath. I needed the attention to see the breath. The awareness was the seeing of what it is that I was pointing or directing my attention towards. So I learned very early on, maybe in the first week or so of practice, that these two things, the breath, the physical sensation, all of the mind in terms of thought and emotion and the physical sensation and all of that, all of the sense data, and then there was the attention I was giving. Two things were happening. I could lose my attention to it, and I could bring my attention back. I could lose my attention, and I could bring my attention back. Now, this is interesting. I always thought I was in control of both the loss of my attention and the return of my attention. But if you look at your experience closely enough, that's not what's happening at all. You didn't choose to leave the breath. It just left on its own. And then you decide, okay, I'll return to the breath. But even the returning to the breath wasn't your decision, because you probably were already on the breath. After you realized you weren't on the breath, you came right back to it. And so even the volitional action wasn't necessary to bring your attention back to the breath. This whole thing has been beyond our control since day one, people. And if that's not a mystery to you, where are you? Because that's a mystery to everyone. See, this thing, this is not a play mystery. This isn't a novel. You know, this is like the real truth of life, the very truth, the essence of life. And meditation is beginning to show us that now. And now no longer does the energy come from me, but from awareness. It's doing itself. The one thing that I can offer it, and it's not even me that's offering this, it's the heart. The deep yearning of the heart is the intentionality to move the awareness into more of a completion in my life. That's what the heart is continuing to issue, that request. And that's why we feel pulled or yearning, or where we feel that hunger and that thirst for freedom. That's where that comes from. It doesn't come from us. It comes from the heart. What is the heart? That's awareness turning back in on itself and looking at itself. There's only one thing. I said two. For a while, there's two. There's me and the mind. I won't go there. But eventually, the mind turns itself into awareness. But that's a separate story. There's only one thing happening here, life. And life turns back in on itself to wake itself up. What do you think is turning back in on it? You? You're not there. We're not turning ourselves back. Life is pulling it out of us, forcing us into our ignorance through the difficulty and struggles that we have in life. We're forced to look at what we're doing to create those difficulties. That's life seeking itself and renewing itself and revitalizing itself and reinterpreting itself back from the harshness and density of its pain to the lightness and love that it is. Sometimes I think I talk too much, but I get excited about it. That's the thing, the excitement is, I say it as I get excited again, is unlimited. It never dampens. If somebody comes in, it's not like that. It's like this. Because you start talking about it, you open to it, and it expresses itself like this. So if I'm putting you off, I apologize. There's not a thing I can do about it unless I take control of myself, which I'm too wise to do. What a fix we find ourselves in. Okay. Oh, dear. What are we doing now? Okay. So now, just stay with me. I know I talk too much. So what am I going to do? I'm going to keep talking. Because I haven't gotten to the, I haven't gotten to the two practices that move in the direction of what I just talked about. And I want to offer you those two practices that feels important to me. So that's why I'm continuing on. All right. So now we're on to something. Okay. So the first practice I'm going to suggest is listen to the word selfless awareness. You might have heard of choiceless awareness. I think Krishnamurti had talked about before, or expanded awareness or all that. That's expanded awareness is you being very quiet and letting the awareness expand, but you're still a placeholder within that. So I'm not talking about a placeholder anymore. I'm talking about selfless awareness where there isn't any placeholder and which awareness is seeing everything, even me, within that expanse. So that's why it's selfless awareness. You can find that as the third foundation, which the more I talk about the third foundation, the deeper I appreciate it, because I think it's this is what the Buddha was pointing towards. He said it in ways that were a little bit obtuse, and at least as it's been rehearsed and practiced and repeated over history, as leaving the mind alone. If the mind's doing that, let it do that. Just be attentive to the fact that it's doing that. If it's doing that, let it do that and be attentive. You take all the different contrasting states of mind that you're supposed to attend to, you have nothing left except attention. Because the contrasting state of mind needs your dispute in order to make it into a thing that I have to take care of, that I have to do something about. And that thing, that contrast, that struggle I'm having with my mind is the very formation of you as the placeholder. Okay, let me just back off and let that seep in, because it's a very important point. Leaving the mind alone means leaving it alone, non-doing, beyond self-conflict, beyond the struggle of what you want the mind to look like as opposed to what is actually arising. In the absence of conflict is the absence of you, because the sense of you is based within its struggle with life, with the moment as being not quite right. I need to go somewhere, turn up the heat, adjust my chair, whatever it is, okay? Leaving the mind alone is leaving yourself out of it. So it's, he's pointing, in my opinion, he's pointing to selfless awareness, selfless. And if we are truly without conflict or struggle within our meditation, it means that there's no placeholder for that meditation to take root. Part of that placeholder can be a commentary on what is being seen. A commentary, listen to, I'm giving you a lot of information today. So just, that conflict creates the sense of a placeholder. The placeholder may look like a commentary on what's occurring, but a commentary is still a sense of self because it distances what is being seen. It separates itself from what is being seen in order so that I have safety. I put distance between myself and what is being seen as my placeholder so that I have some safety to what it is that's occurring. Selfless awareness does not put anything between you, doesn't put any distance between you when it's arising. So it's just that which is arising. It doesn't ask for your distance to anything. It's everything is seen because awareness does the seeing, not you. It's not as if I don't put distance between me that I don't stop seeing. That was just distance for safety. This is selfless awareness, which is awareness on its own merit. Sees, holds all life. Sees and holds all of life. Selfless awareness. leaving the mind alone, not distancing ourselves from what is being seen. And when you see yourself putting distance between you, pay attention to the distance, be aware of the distance, and the distance will close. If you want it to, if you want to be inside the experience, if it said, if you want to eliminate yourself so that you come into the inside of the experience as the experience itself, release the need to have distance between you and what is occurring. That's called surrendering our separation. Surrendering our separation becomes the way now. I know I'm going too fast. And I know all of you are kind of hanging on like a tornado wind is blowing and you're at a flagpole and you know you're vertical to the or horizontal to the ground because of, I'm giving you so much information so quickly. But I don't know. Why not, right? Why not just take it all in? And you can sort it out in your own time. Okay, that's the first of two practices that start transforming the way you see. Transforming and become so thinned. You become so thinned at this point. Somebody leaves the window open, you're awake. All right? This is now your identity begins to shift. Okay? I give you, all right, I have to do a check here. Raise your hand if you're following all this or whatever. Okay. Raise your hand if you're not following all this. And that, okay. 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 So let's just be quiet for a second here. You see, we can restore sanity if we're feeling a little bit overburdened by the words. Immediate sanity. Stillness is immediate sanity. I get excited about these things. Like it's like, whoa. That's how close sanity is. So let's be still together. This is probably the greater teaching to all the stuff I've been espousing here. Isn't it amazing? I'm just flicking through holding stillness as I flick through the screen. Just to see you. You're being seen. Awareness is seeing. Okay, so let me get to the second practice. And that's inquiry. And we spoke about that some. But there can be intellectual inquiry, and that's just an interested mind that wants to add to its knowledge base. And that's not what we're really looking for here. Some people call this sacred inquiry, and I like that because it takes us out of the knowledge accumulation phase. And but it's supposed to evoke realization. It's the way the mind works in cooperation with awareness, and those two can work cooperatively, sacred awareness being one of the ways it does that. So that it goes to the root of things, as Rumi would say. It wants to uncover what is hidden, what is deeply defended. It wants to expose itself to life, to awareness. It's what I was talking about, was life coming back in on itself. It wants a full realization. It doesn't want an intellectual understanding that has some degree of satisfaction to it just because it's emotionally explained now. That doesn't do anything to its uprooting. To its uprooting, you have to re-experience or experience for the first time that which has remained hidden. And so the dyads are an attempt to do that. The dyads move in two, they ask a phase one question, that's the first question, and then they ask a phase two question. Are we able to look at each of these in accordance to that? They're both legitimate. And the unveiling of one eventually leads to the other. But if we can send, we dives deeply into our psyche and inquiry, into the forbidden areas where it's dark in there, where we don't know what's going on. Like what, the question can be anything. It can be it can seem like an intellectual question, like what is ignorance? But what is ignorance is not, that yearning of sacred inquiry is not satisfied by reading a text on what is ignorance. It's not. It goes in and looks and says, my God, that's ignorance. It doesn't say that. It realizes that. And so that then becomes conscious. And it has made or transformed the unconscious into the conscious. And inquiry can be very directed in that way. And because there's vestiges in each one of us that are different in where we're holding, inquiry is self-directed. It's from your own interest in yourself to expose yourself in your own time. Nobody should or ever force inquiry upon you. They can suggest areas of inquiry and hope evoke the pattern and curiosity that inquiry requires itself. But the readiness to ask a question means you're willing to evolve out of that predicament. That's what your willingness to ask a question. Oh, what is going on here? That excitement comes in curiosity. It means that you're ready to really face yourself. If it's a drudgery, oh God, what? I don't want to go. Don't do it. It's the resistance is so treacherous at that point that if you did uncover it, it would probably overwhelm. So you need to do some skillful means to build up a sense of psychic safety before you plummet into some of these questions. That should make sense to you. You know, so much of what I teach really has to do with staying within yourself. And unless you do that, there are ways that meditation can become a psychotic, can induce psychosis because you're not ready for what it is that's going to be shown. But curiosity and asking a question that feels compelling shows that we're ready to move in that direction. If you don't have those, fine. They will come, and they come in their own time. The whole thing comes in its own time. Everything I'm saying comes in its own time.